Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Over the past few decades, the mission of the American military has expanded beyond warfighting. And although this may be something that in recent years we've become more aware of, it's not really something that is new. Our guest for this morning, Gordon Adams, says that over the past 45 years, the Department of Defense has emerged as the dominant tool of U.S. statecraft. This morning, in this first hour of the show, we'll be talking about why it is that defense seems to have eclipsed the Department of State as the dominant agency in national security policy, and about what happens when you ask the military to carry out missions for which it's really not trained and perhaps not suited. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest, Gordon Adams. He is a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He's taught international affairs and national security at the Elliott School of International Affairs at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C., where he also directed the Security Policy Studies Program. Before that, he was deputy director of the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London. He spent a year there. Between February of 93 and December of 97, he was associate director at the Office of Management and Budget, responsible for oversight of all U.S. foreign affairs and national security budgeting for the Executive Office of the President. And before that, he was founder and director of the Defense Budget Project. That's a nonpartisan research center in Washington, where they work on a number of areas like the defense budget, defense economics, and defense policy issues. And at that time, when he was there, he did a lot of writing, reports, papers dealing with issues like future defense budgets and the defense industry and defense policymaking. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, of course, questions, comments are welcome from people who are listening. All we ask of callers is that they just try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving along, get as many different people as possible. But of course, anyone's welcome with their input. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Dr. Adams, hello.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Pretty good.
Well, thanks for joining us, for talking with us. Perhaps just to begin, one way to begin would be to talk a little bit about, give some examples of non-traditional missions, things other than warfighting, that in recent years we have asked the Department of Defense to do.
Yeah, it's getting to be a fairly long laundry list of things we're asking the military to do for us. Back in the Cold War days, we basically looked to the military to handle war and to handle deterrence, to prevent war from happening or to win it if we had to. We didn't always succeed in doing that, but that was the mission. In the post-Cold War era, if that's the word, or maybe it's the Long War era, I'm not sure now, we have a very widely geographically dispersed military, and we're asking them to do all kinds of things that they didn't used to do. Our combatant commanders, as they're called, who are the regional commanders for places like the Middle East and the Gulf region, South America, the Pacific, Europe, have taken on almost a quasi-diplomatic role. We don't have regional diplomats. We have regional commanders who spend a lot of time going to governments, to defense ministries, to foreign ministries, and negotiating on national security issues on behalf of the United States. So we're asking them to be diplomats. With the Iraq War, we've really begun to expand the inventory. We're now asked them to be reconstruction specialists, humanitarian assistance deliverers, foreign assistance deliverers, trainers and equippers not only of military but also of police and security forces. We've got practically now a full-service military deployed forward, doing a lot of jobs that some other instruments of American statecraft might well be doing.
Mm-hmm. Now, while this is something that, as I said, we might now be more conscious of, particularly over the last, say, 5 years with the Iraq War, one of the things that I think, one point that I'm sure that you would want to make is that if you're looking for the roots of this, you do have to go back a little bit further. And it certainly is the case, if you go back far enough in American history, that the State Department was much more important than, well, we didn't even have a Defense Department, but the State Department was much more important than the War Department. And that over time, the relative status and importance of those two parts of the government have changed. And I suppose that the big thing that pushed that change was actually, even before the Cold War, it was World War II.
That's right. Although after World War II, we demobilized the military pretty quickly. When one has to say, right after the end of the Second World War, the State Department really was the central leader, if you will, of American national security policy. The doctrine that dominated the Cold War era began with a telegram from George Kennan, who was a diplomat in Moscow at the time. Although George Marshall was a uniformed officer as Secretary of State, he served, and he also was, of course, the developer and the namesake for the Marshall Plan, which was an economic assistance program. And the military had taken a kind of a backseat, but two critical decisions got made that influenced this. One was the decision around, during, and after the Korean War to maintain a large permanent military establishment, an active duty force, which the United States had done only minimally, practically not at all, before the First World War, and very little between the First and Second World Wars. But the Cold War led to the establishment of a permanent active-duty military, an expansion of the Pentagon's budget, and increasing influence of the Secretary of Defense in the policy process. The other set of decisions, we really haven't studied much, but it's quite interesting to note that the State Department, whose job has been primarily diplomacy, Secretaries of State and the Foreign Service made a decision back in the late 40s and early 50s that if it involved program, they didn't want to do it. And what I mean by that is if we're going to do foreign assistance, if we're going to do international broadcasting, if we're going to do public diplomacy, if we're going to do things like the Peace Corps, these were all missions that diplomats did not do. What they did was negotiate, represent, and report. But they did not run programs. So to some degree, a series of decisions on the civilian side of American national security toolkit were a decision to disperse the capabilities that we might have on the civilian side into a lot of separate agencies, each of whom did a little piece. So the USAID was established in 61 as a separate organization, not as part of the State Department. USIA, which did public diplomacy, was not part of the State Department. A series of capabilities grew up, but that were very dispersed, not coherently organized. And so the counterweight that the State Department might have posed strategically and in terms of resources simply got dispersed. Mm-hmm. And in the face of a very major challenge from the Soviet Union, the military's role became dominant in the definition of American strategy and in our statecraft.
So it's interesting when you look at that these in a sense, not directly diplomatic functions that you would think arguably could come under the umbrella of the State Department when they said, well, that's not really what we do. And so then we, in a sense, created independent entities to do that. And then those developed into their own interests with their own constituencies, their own budgets, their own leaderships, their own concerns that drained away potential influence, potential money, I suppose, from the State Department at the same time that we were building up defense. So I guess one question would be, when, at the time that we were building up defense, were we consciously starving state of resources? And when you lay it out the way that you have, maybe we were, but at the same time, maybe at the State Department, they were in a sense complicit in that because they were, when they were talking about things that the State Department might do, the State Department said, well, no, that's not our thing.
That's right. It's a little bit of both. We've had fairly large assistance programs at various points in time. We've had what they call economic support funds, economic assistance to countries that are allies of ours. We used to have a fairly sizable development assistance budget, but they were run by different places. Policy for our strategic economic aid was run by the State Department, but they didn't implement the program because they didn't know how. They handed that off to the Agency for International Development, which implemented both its own development program and this kind of economic support that we gave to states that were allies, whether or not it was important to their development. But the problem that you develop when you do it that way is that you develop tensions inside the American government. AID worries about whether the State Department will take it over. The State Department would like to take it over but doesn't have a development mission, so they want to use the resources for something other than development, more strategically focused economic aid. And we waste an awful lot of energy as a result in Washington, D.C., arguing about money, money, who's got the money, but we have not developed a coherent and strategic view for our foreign policy engagement globally into which we could incorporate military capabilities as a supporting tool.
Do you think that, and I ask this question having read some things that you've written about this, that a part of the problem is that, particularly when you make comparisons between the Departments of Defense and State, that it's much easier to say what the mission of the Department of Defense is, and that it's a little bit more fuzzy when you start talking about what the mission of the Department of State is?
Well, that is certainly true. I can testify to that at the moment because one of the things that I'm doing here at the Wilson Center is working on a book on national security budgeting and resource planning. And it takes forever to describe the many ways in which the United States engages the world through its non-military tools because there are so many different instruments and so many different programs. The weakness here overall is that there is no strategic brain inside the State Department and no span of control inside the State Department that would allow you to plan a strategy, focus the resources, target them at the countries that you want to deal with, and make sure that they are properly implemented. There is a kind of a functioning chaos, a diaspora of institutions, a diaspora of authorities, and therefore a diaspora of impact. When you put that together with the fact that the Foreign Service training does not really emphasize either strategic planning or program management in its officers. They're wonderful people, our diplomats, but these are skill sets that they're not really given in their training process. You have a State Department that doesn't think strategically, it doesn't organize itself strategically, and it doesn't implement in a coherent way. You contrast that with the Defense Department, which has a regularized, routinized strategic planning process, budget planning process, which everybody loves to criticize, but it's the best long-term strategic planning in government. Well, it's simply not a fair fight, if you will, on an institutional basis, when the Defense Department can think strategy, can link resources to the strategy, and can implement those capabilities in the way it develops and deploys forces and uses them. The State Department doesn't have the same coherence. So that bureaucratic coherence that the Pentagon has gives it a real leg up in the institutional struggle in American government for what policy is going to be and who's going to be in charge. And you see that in Iraq. I mean, Iraq is now the poster child for this dilemma because we've asked our forces deployed forward to do a whole lot of things they were not trained and skilled to do, like build local hospitals, schools, dig wells, provide political advice to local governments, deliver humanitarian assistance, a whole bunch of things that you would have thought we had the civilian capability to do. But once Jerry Bremer got there and looked at the tools that he had in his toolkit, it was really the military that could do the job better than the chaos that affected the foreign policy institutions of the United States. And so a lot of the program development for defense that now we're dealing with on a global basis came out of this Iraq experience, where the only coherent, organized capability we had to deliver on the ground was coming from people in uniform.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Gordon Adams. He is at the moment a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He's also taught international affairs and national security at the Elliott School of International Affairs at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and has been writing about, thinking about defense issues for quite a long time. We're talking this morning about the increasing tendency of the military and the Department of Defense to be given missions and take on missions that are something other than war fighting, and in fact how it is over time that the relative power, influence, importance, significance of the Departments of Defense and Departments of State have traded places, or at least that in certainly since the end of World War II. Defense, it seems, has become more important and influential, and state less. Questions welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. There was at the when we got to the point where we were talking about the end of the Cold War, there seemed to be this relatively brief moment when in Washington, people who were interested in defense policy were talking about what. Given that we were now probably not going to fight this big land war in Europe that we thought we once were going to fight against the Soviet Union, what now was going to be the mission, the purpose of our military? And people started talking about different missions, different kind of structure. In fact, I think at that time even people were talking about new missions for the military that were kind of like some of the things that we're being asked that they're being asked to do now. And so I wonder whether it was the case that for a lot of this non-combat stuff, like they're doing in Iraq, reconstruction and humanitarian assistance and providing training to security and military of other countries, all of that, whether it was the case that those missions came up and the Department of Defense said, oh, yes, we can do that, and sort of rushed to grab that piece knowing that they needed some mission, or whether it was the case that someone, and I suppose it ultimately, I guess it would have been the President of the United States, said, look, here's the mission that has to be done, and turned to the Department of Defense and said, go to it.
Well, it's a very interesting question that right at the origins of this period that we're now living in, we did, because I was there at the time in the Office of Management and Budget, we did have a series of smaller crises, nothing like the Iraq situation, but a series of smaller crises that had to be dealt with. And in discussions in the White House, it always turned on who had the capability to deliver things. And, you know, a lot of that capability is in the military. If you were dealing, for example, with the Rwandan crisis, we didn't step in and separate the parties. Some people feel we should have. But we did do an awful lot of work with the refugee camps outside the edges of Rwanda. You know, the State Department, big secret, by the way, they do have an Air Force, but it's not the kind of Air Force the Air Force has. It's smaller planes and helicopters, about 150 of them. But the Defense Department has all that heavy lift capability. And we've used that before. We've consistently used it. What's critical here is the policy and political direction over the way that we use it. And that policy and political direction ought to be in the White House. It ought to be in the State Department. And pretty much was through the 1990s. The shift in Iraq was a shift towards saying the strategy will be shaped by the Department of Defense and the implementation will be shaped by the Department of Defense. And the planning for post-conflict reconstruction and stabilization, such as it was, and it wasn't very good, will be done inside the Department of Defense. And we will simply not empower these civilian tools to be capable of delivering these things.
I suppose, you know, another question one might ask is, again, when these missions came up, particularly in the case of Iraq, one could imagine that then that the president could have turned, instead of turning to the Secretary of Defense, if indeed that's what he did, he could have turned to the Secretary of State and said, look, it may be that you don't feel equipped to do this, or it may be that historically the State Department has not felt that this was the kind of thing that they did. But the fact is that this is something we need now, and I want you to do this. Could something like that, could you imagine something like that have happened? Or, you know, so I think people would like to lay a lot of this at the door of the president, of President Bush, for having been involved in marginalizing state and you know, enhancing the power of defense at the expense of State Department. Do you think, in fact, that happened?
I think it eroded over time. To reflect on the question that you had asked earlier, it eroded over time more than it was a case of, if you will, a greedy military seizing a mission that it wanted desperately to own. It's more like it came to them by accretion, and then with the arrival of Iraq, it was seized. And that clearly was the case, that the Department of Defense simply did not trust the capabilities of the State Department and AID to deliver in Iraq. They also had a fairly optimistic view of what was going to happen after the war ended, I must say, so they didn't do much of their own planning. But they seized control of the mission. The underlying question here I think we need to ask ourselves, which doesn't always get asked, is how does the United States want to engage the world? What are the elements of our security policy? How do we want to be seen in the world? What are the issues that we think are critical? Are they poverty? Are they terrorism? Are they proliferation? Are they failed states and problems of governance? Are they transnational issues like international crime? And once we know what the agenda of the things is that we want to grapple with around the world, what is the right mix of tools in the American toolkit in order to grapple with those things? How do we capture the right synergies of a military capability, a diplomatic capability, a foreign assistance capability, public diplomacy, so that we have the right tools lined up in the toolkit? Over time, we've eroded the civilian tools. We have not funded them adequately. Now they're not properly trained or organized to deliver these things. And then it becomes a case of default. Only the military has the resources, can raise the resources, can send the people there, can act quickly. If they come and ask the question you asked, David, which is, hey, you know, you may have not have done this before, but I sure want you to do it now, I can tell you the organization would not have been ready to do it. AID, one would think of as the kind of reconstruction aid deliverer. Well, AID got into a mode of long-term development-type contracts overseas that were on projects that would take 3, 5, 10, sometimes 15 years to bear fruit. Not that they're bad projects. They just take time and they rely on a secure environment. They simply were way, way understaffed and underprepared for operating in a relatively hostile environment where contracting had to happen quickly, where people had to be capable of moving fast in the field. This was not a skill set that any but a very small handful of people at AID were capable of doing. And that small handset was in the Office of Transition Initiatives. There just weren't enough people and there wasn't enough money for them to be organized and respond effectively. So the military tried to do it. Of course, the hidden secret here is the military doesn't do these things terribly well. It is not central to the military skill set. They're not naturally diplomats. They're not naturally developers. They're not naturally governors or reconstructors. These are things that they sort of learn on the job because there isn't anybody else around who can do it, but it doesn't get done very well because they're no more trained to it than diplomats are or aid deliverers are. We just have weakened that set of a toolkit tools for us and don't have people who can do it effectively.
You know, I wonder if part of the if the Department of State has been weakened, or if we don't think about them right away for missions other than pure diplomacy, I wonder if that has something to do with the fact that diplomacy is it's a long and difficult process, and sometimes the gains are really small, and I think that's just part of the reality of diplomacy, but I wonder if it's if we are somehow unwilling to accept that, and rather than saying that's simply the way the business of diplomacy works, that we are more likely to say that that's an indication of the fact that the diplomacy is not working well, or that our diplomats are not doing what they should do, and that somehow we're blaming them for lack of more dramatic results when often diplomacy is really not about dramatic results.
You know, part of that is a question of the way we view diplomats in this country. And that's, you know, the way we view diplomats is as a kind of a weak military. That is to say, these are people who, you know, wear striped pants suits and carry teacups and tend to negotiate in corridors of palaces, but aren't really very effective people. And that's it's an American predisposition, amply reinforced over time because we're a country of can-do, will-make-it-happen, hurry-up, get-it-done people, and that's the ethos of the soldier. You know, the soldier doesn't wait around and negotiate with a teacup in his hand. And so as a culture, we value the capacity to produce those results, produce them tough, produce them fast, and we don't particularly value the quiet, long-term, careful negotiations that need to happen for statecraft, for a policy to be effective. You know, it was a Chinese military counselor and general, Sun Tzu, who wrote probably 2,500 years ago that general succeeds best who succeeds through the stratagem of what he called the sheathed sword. That is, the general did best who never had to draw his sword. He did it because his statecraft worked, because his diplomacy worked, because his forces were there as the support tool for his diplomacy to achieve his objectives. If he had to end up using his force, his statecraft had failed, and he had to use force to overcome that failure. We've had a tendency in recent years to reach for the gun first before we've figured out how our statecraft can work and how we use our military to do it. But as you say, that requires a lot of patience. That requires sitting back and saying, you know, I'm going to let this play itself out a little bit. We didn't do that in Iraq. We didn't wait for it to play itself out. We just reached for the gun and went for it. It looks weak. It looks like we're not supposed to do that. It looks like it can have a quick and rapid impact on change. And, of course, what we've seen in Iraq, and it's not the first lesson, is that using military force to accomplish the broader purposes of statecraft can easily fail. It can prove even counterproductive. But as a people, we don't seem to have the patience to allow the mix to work.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, though, that simply because historically the military has not been trained and equipped to do these missions, does that necessarily mean that they're not capable of doing that, or that with some retooling, some re-education, a different kind of training, that in fact the military could do that, or could do that better? Or do you think that somehow that the two missions are just fundamentally incompatible, and that's just saying, well, let's make the military better at this, is the wrong way to approach the problem?
This is what I call the question of core competence. Every institution in government, every segment of the bureaucracy has something it does better than other things that it does. Diplomats negotiate better than they do run programs. Foreign assistance deliverers deliver foreign assistance better than they do shoot. Soldiers and the military's mission, their core competence, is their ability to deliver force and deter through the possession of force. That is the core competence of the military. If you go into any military academy or you go into any office in the Pentagon, they'll tell you that's the job they really know how to do. Something like reconstruction, something like diplomacy, even some aspects of training and equipping police, for example, are not things that are core to the military mission. You could train people to do that in the military, but then the question you have to ask yourself is, if it's not their core mission, are they going to want to do it and want to do it well? And what will be the impact of giving them that mission on their core capability? And they used to complain throughout the 1990s about this specific issue. They were asked to go to the Balkans. They were asked to police. They were asked to do training programs. They were asked to advise governments. And the military would regularly complain that this was peacekeeping missions were eroding their core competence, that the force was less ready as a consequence of taking on those missions because they weren't being exercised, trained, and equipped to do those missions. And I think we have to listen to that lesson. There may be different ways in which the military needs to be organized for the 21st century, you know, when you're dealing with terrorists and other things, but they are essentially the kinetic part of statecraft. You know, their job is to deliver or to be capable of delivering kinetic effects to get results. It doesn't always make them happy to hear me say it, but I like to say that's a support capability for your statecraft. It is not the leading edge of your statecraft. And the danger in making it the leading edge of kinetic force, the leading edge of your statecraft, is that you find yourself less and less beloved in the world, which, of course, is the case today. By delivering kinetically without thinking about delivering an assistance in statecraft, we are not a particularly beloved animal in the world today. Not particularly because the military are evil people. They're not. But we've made it the leading edge of our statecraft. And the danger is that you can no longer accomplish your purposes if you do that.
We have a caller I will get to just in a moment. We're a little bit past our midpoint here, and I want to introduce again our guest for anyone who might have just tuned in the last 10 or 15 minutes. We're talking with Gordon Adams. He is a fellow with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He also has taught international affairs and national security at the Elliott School of International Affairs at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C., spent a year as deputy director of the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London. Between February of 93 and December of 97, he was associate director at the Office of Management and Budget and was responsible for oversight of all U.S. foreign affairs and national security budgeting for the Executive Office of the President. And then, going back before that, he was the founder and director of the Defense Budget Project. That's a nonpartisan research center in Washington, D.C., where they're interested in a number of issues like the defense budget and defense economics. And he has written a lot on these subjects, including the defense industry and defense policymaking. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone in Urbana. This is line number one. Hello.
Good morning, Mr. Adams.
Good morning.
Could it be that one reason, in addition to those that you have mentioned, that the State Department has lost some prominence is a distrust of the quote-unquote intellectual establishment by the current administration, which I began to notice, I think, when Ronald Reagan was president, and it's, and to my perception, that distrust has been magnified beyond reason by the current incompetent occupant of the White House.
Not sure I know exactly what you mean by that.
Just to say that the right-wing propagandists have railed against the pointy-headed intellectuals from the Ivy League dominating U.S. foreign policy, whether that's true or not, for some few decades now. And that unjustified criticism is beginning to have an effect. Do you perceive that?
Yes, I think probably to some degree. It can be overstated. There does seem to be a fair amount of resistance at the top or near the top to people who think flexibly, broadly, and intellectually about issues of how to engage the world. You know, an awful lot of the people who are implementing American national security policy, fortunately, don't come from the Ivy League, and they're pretty smart, and they're pretty good. But I think there is some of that. It was not true, I think, in the Nixon administration. So I wouldn't say it's characteristically Republican.
No,
there was much more
characteristically American reactionary, and I think the current administration is more conservative than Republican.
That may well be. I'm not a specialist in, you know, American national politics, but my sense is that they do represent a particular wing of the Republican Party, and it seems to be fairly dominant right now.
That's right.
And it's not a wing, let me put it another way. One of the big impacts on national security policy in this administration, I think clearly, was an intellectual impact, and it was the impact of the neoconservative movement. That has longer roots in American policy. It goes back to Vietnam. It goes back to the Team B exercise over whether or not the Soviet Union was militarily capable in the 1970s. And it goes to a lot of people who were in the Reagan administration. And frankly, they had many of them were Ivy League, and they had an intellectual view of the international universe. But it was a view which asserted the preeminence of the United States, asserted the requirement to use military power in order to establish that preeminence, and asserted it as the primary tool of statecraft. It was not a point of view, the neoconservative view, Richard Perle and Doug Feith and people of that kind. It was, it was not their view that negotiation was the way to establish American preeminence and they were very, very committed to American preeminence. Anybody who wants to get into that in more detail, I strongly recommend a book called The New American Militarism by Professor Andy Bacevich at Boston University, which is a very detailed study of the emergence of that stream of thinking and the way the United States should engage the world. It comes back to the question I was raising before. How do we engage the world? And I have to say that was a very analytical and intellectual view. I happen to think it was wrong, in fact, counterproductive. But nonetheless, it did become a dominant view in the Republican Party on the right. And much of the agenda that has been brought to us since has been brought to us via that stream of thinking, which emphasizes preeminence, preemption, and the uses of American military power to establish American dominance, if you will, in the 21st century.
Well, so it's kind of selective. In your listening to your opening discussion, I got to thinking, yes, we have used it, but when we have withheld our power, say, especially in this the horrible mess in this Darfur region of Sudan, there's kind of a gross imbalance. We've gone overboard in Iraq, and we've done what apparently amounts to a very little in the truly horrible humanitarian mess in Sudan. Now, I know they're not directly related, but still that imbalance of perceived action really seems to stand out for me.
I think there's two issues there. I think it's a very, very good point, and there are two issues there. One is that, frankly, the genocide in Darfur would not be seen by a neoconservative analyst as part of the vital national interests of the United States. So that's one thing exercising there. The other is that American leadership has not been terribly good at mobilizing the international community. Part of the problem with the neoconservative view of the world is it tends to rely on us and us alone, and then when you use the military instrument and rely solely on American capabilities, what you end up with is the rest of the world, the ROW, if you will, saying, well, the Americans just want to do this thing by themselves. We won't bother. So we haven't mobilized a capability, our own included, to deal with the Darfur genocide. We haven't mobilized the international capability. We have supported the African Union force, but they have a very limited rules of engagement that don't allow them to actually stop what's happening in Darfur. So it's not strategic. We're not going to use force to do it, and we're not effectively mobilizing an international strategy that would deal with that problem.
Thank you very much. Right. You are most impressive.
Well, thanks for the call. It seems that if we were going to do things differently and move away from this place that we've been, where we have maybe, to say the least, relied too much on the military as a tool of statecraft. I'm sure you would say, other people would say, well, that is a legitimate tool of statecraft, but maybe it doesn't want to be the only one, and it certainly doesn't want to be the one that you reach for first. If we're going to do something a little bit differently, then it strikes me that what we might well have to do is try to provide greater resources to all of those other areas, those other non-military areas, and then perhaps bring them together under a kind of umbrella, whether that be the Department of State and the Secretary of State or something else, to provide for a little bit more coordinated action and oversight in terms of some kind of coherent foreign policy. That sounds like a tall order, but it sounds as if that would really be the thing that we would have to do.
I'm becoming more and more a fan of that, David, as I look at this imbalance of capability. We have this diaspora of 15 or 20 different institutions doing diplomacy, public diplomacy, foreign assistance, lending, and the like. We don't have strategic planning capability there. We've tended to starve some important parts of it in terms of resources. And it may be that the only way to balance and then effectively integrate our tools with the military, which I believe is an important tool, is by doing so by creating a counterweight, is literally by creating what one might call, for example, a Department of Foreign Affairs rather than the Department of State. It will require changing the culture in the State Department and the Foreign Service, better sense of strategic planning, better knowledge of programming and management, better awareness of budgeting and relations with Congress. There are a lot of problems that our foreign policy community has right now that are going to have to be fixed. But if we could pull all those resources into one place, think about them strategically, integrate them so that you could actually deliver reconstruction capability or foreign aid capability or economic support for a government or a public diplomacy program, and you did it driven by a strategic brain at the top that said, here's the way we engage the world. Then, at the White House level, and you'd have to do it there, you could integrate that instrument with your military instrument and appropriately assign responsibilities. Instead, we've got a patchwork quilt on one side and a juggernaut on the other.
Hmm. You know, it strikes me that there is a, perhaps you could see that as a parallel effort on the side of intelligence and intelligence gathering, at least in this respect, that since 9/11, one of the things that we said was within the government and the military, we have a number of different agencies that are responsible for gathering intelligence. And the problem that we saw was that they were competing with one another for resources. There were turf battles. There was poor coordination. They didn't want to share information. And that undercut the larger effort of intelligence and national security. So then we said, well, we need to pull them all together. There needs to be some kind of centralized oversight. And in fact, we already had someone who was called the Director of Central Intelligence, not the Director of the CIA, but somebody who actually was supposed to be doing that who wasn't. So we did this restructuring. We tried to pull things together. We tried to actually give that person some power. And it turns out that it doesn't seem to have made a great deal of difference. At least it hasn't done the dramatic thing that we thought it would happen. So now it seems to me that you would face similar difficulties in trying to do what you and I have just talked about for probably the same sorts of reasons.
It is extraordinarily hard to pull together the American government organizations and make them work in harness. If you want a classic poster child for that, look at the Department of Homeland Security, which we created partly in response, largely in response to 9/11, but which is still a fractured collection of baronies and independent capabilities, struggling as much inside the department to gain or protect turf as it is focused and centered on the problems of Homeland Security. It is close to a disaster, and I rather fear that making a suggestion that one pull together these foreign assistance and foreign policy capabilities is likely to run into the propeller of people saying, yeah, well, we tried that with intelligence, we tried that with Homeland Security. What on earth makes you think it's going to work any better or any differently in a new Department of Foreign Affairs? And that's a legitimate protest because it is very hard. What we do know is it doesn't work now. It is ineffective. We do know that it's not, all these capabilities are all in one budget area. They're all in the foreign policy budget, even though they're separate institutions. So you wouldn't be ripping pieces out of other organizations. You do know that you'd have to do something about the culture to make it work, and it would be very, very hard. The classic example of how hard it is and how long it takes is the Department of Defense. And the Department of Defense was created in 1947, bringing together the Army and the Navy and Marines and the fledgling Department of the Air Force. And it was another 14 years before Secretary of Defense Bob McNamara came in and said, we need a brain at the top of this organization. This is all very well and good, but I, as Secretary of Defense, don't know what the strategy is. I don't know whether the forces you're building meet the strategy. I need a mechanism at my level that can coordinate all you guys instead of everybody protecting their Air Force turf or their Army turf, or their Marine Corps turf or their Navy turf. And that was in 1961. It was another 25 years before we passed a bill called Goldwater-Nichols in 1986, which said to the services, if you want to become a flag officer, a general, you know, one-star, two-star, three-star, four-star, you can't become a flag officer unless you have served in what they call a joint billet. They call it purple sometimes. You have to have worked on the joint staff somewhere outside of your service for enough time and in enough ways that you qualify. And the impact of Goldwater-Nichols on the Department of Defense and the military has been actually revolutionary, because for the first time you begin to have an officer corps that knows how the other guys work and understands that when you deliver force in the field, it isn't an army or a navy or an air force. Oh, sure, there are elements of that. But it is a combined force that the local commander delivers. And in sheer combat terms, Gulf War I and Gulf War II amply demonstrated that they've learned that lesson, and it's beginning to be implemented. So to shift around in the State Department and make a Department of Foreign Affairs and make it effective is a long-term agenda. What we know is it doesn't work now, and better to start now than to wait 25 years from now when we think it might be worse or it would work worse. Mm.
We have a couple of callers and just a couple of minutes. I'm trying to get at least one, if not both. Let's go to Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, thank you, and thank you for the program. Maybe the dialogue has already answered this question for me, but what do you think about the current proposals for a Department of Peace, which I know is you know, building a little bit of steam? And then the second part, have you looked at that, and you know, does that solve some of these problems? And the second question is, I'm a big fan of a book by Neil Sheehan called The Bright Shining Lie that was written in 88 about Vietnam, and how it describes AID development really as kind of leading to the whole strategic Hamlet concept that really kind of started to plunge off the edge in Vietnam. Do you think that's a good reference for me to continue to use? So Department of Peace and Neil Sheehan's book, and I will listen offline.
All right. Thank you.
Both really good questions. I'm skeptical of a Department of Peace. The reason I say that is because two reasons. One is because peace as a separate department says the people who are our diplomats and our aid deliverers are something else. They're not peace. What are they? You know, if the purpose of statecraft is not to go to war all the time, but in fact to stabilize the world and build a better world, then I would like all of our tools of statecraft to be dedicated to that agenda and not segmented out into another department. The proof of the pudding, if you will, was in the creation of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, which did some wonderful work over the, I guess it was 1961 to 1999 that it existed, so 38 years, did some wonderful arms control negotiations, but was always marginalized as part of the strategic thinking of the United States government. They became a turf defender. They defended the arms control turf instead of making arms control a tool in the toolkit that all elements of statecraft used in order to achieve their objectives. So there's a real risk in creating a separate department. People have proposed creating a Department of Development and segmenting that out from the State Department and AID. I think it carries the same risk that you separate out the development mission, and it's kind of like carving a weak lamb out of the herd. The wolves get that one first. It doesn't strengthen the mission. You want to build that mission into your overall statecraft. On the reconstruction question, or on the question of Neil Sheehan and A Bright Shining Lie, wonderful book, and I think the point, if I understand the point being made, is really important. And that is to recognize that even though we have encountered problems of reconstruction and stabilization in post-conflict states, which is a euphemism for saying we haven't done very well in Iraq and Afghanistan, we need to abolish our hubris. We need to be somewhat humble about the capability of our government, or frankly any government, to build conditions of reconstructed society, stabilized society, democratic institutions in other countries. This was a gift that the neoconservatives brought us, and it was preceded by the Strategic Hamlet effort in Vietnam. Our ability to accomplish our objectives on our own in Iraq or Afghanistan is extraordinarily limited by our lack of skill, by the long-term timing that it takes to accomplishment, by the fact that just by being there, we also become not only part of the solution but part of the problem. And we don't, I think, at this point have adequate humility about our ability to accomplish this objective in any country in the world. Right now, I would say in Iraq, we're not accomplishing that objective, and we are to some degree fooling ourselves if we think that we're creating a responsible, effective, responsive governance in Baghdad.
I want to try to get real quick to our last caller in Charleston. I'll have to ask you to be very brief, though. Go ahead, please.
Yes, your guest has pretty much answered what I was going to ask, and I want to say that there is no humility in international imperialism and hegemony. It is survival under violent conditions. Somehow we're going to pass that on to the victims of the very thing that we are doing, and the horrors of that are all around us. This world is in chaos. Thank you.
Well, that's a pretty pessimistic view. Can you manage to be a little bit more optimistic than that?
Can I find a bright spot?
Yeah, in the face of apparent reality.
Well, I think the part of the issue. I'm a fairly hopeful person, just personally, and once this nightmare of Iraq is over, and I think it will be over largely outside our poor power to add or detract, as the poet says, we're still going to face the dilemma of how we engage the world. And you can engage the world in fear, or you can engage the world in hope, to put it quite crudely, but simply. And engaging it in hope means dealing with the underlying issues, poverty, governance, identity conflicts, transnational issues, and doing so by utilizing all of the instruments of statecraft and by engaging in partnerships and alliances in order to accomplish those objectives. There's a lot to be done. I think it can be done, but we're going to have to get out from under the cloud of counter-terrorist messages and we need to fight fire with fire before we're going to get there.
There we must end with our thanks to our guest, Gordon Adams. He's a fellow with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He was previously director of security policy studies at George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs, and before that was associate director for national security and international affairs at the Office of Management and Budget. And Dr. Adams, thank you very much.
Thank you.